Good evening, everyone. My name is Kristen Walton, and I'm an alcoholic. I want to thank Chris. I want to thank you for inviting me to come and speak tonight. It's a privilege and an honor to get to do anything, to be asked and invited anywhere, and that's the truth. I have one question for y'all. Who is excited about recovery up in here right now? Make some noise. I mean, really. Okay, what? Seriously. Thank you all for laughing with me, smiling out loud. Once again, my name is Kristen Walton, and I am a recovered alcoholic. I am... My sobriety date is November 3rd, 2009. I have absolutely nothing to do with that. I surrendered. I'll back up a little bit. I guess we're supposed to talk about what our life was like, what happened, and what we are like now. So I don't want to get into too much of, oh, I grew up in a family that was dysfunctional. I'm from New York. My parents divorced. I was 4 years old, I guess. And my father moved to California to live with Uncle Randy. You know, quite frankly, back in the day, that was not as accepted as it is today. And I think my father, he did the best he could, trying to go against his grain in the way that he was made to do the right thing. But eventually he just, I guess, couldn't do it anymore. So my mother raised myself, my sister, and my brother. I was 4, my sister was 2, and my brother was 6. And she put herself through nursing school. We moved 18 times, 3 different states, before I graduated high school. So there's a lot of little things that I know now that I didn't know then, in terms of I never let anyone in. I had a hard time making friends because I think that I thought that we would just move away again and I would never see these people anyway. I always felt different than everyone else. I never really felt a part of anything. I was an overachiever. I wanted to be the best at everything so I could get, good job, Kristen, man. You did a really good job, never got it. So I started drinking and using drugs when I was 13 years old. And at that time, it was my ticket to cool. You know what I mean? I felt like I was a part of something, that I was accepted. So other than geographics, moving around, trying to be an overachiever, I was on the track team. I was in the band. Scholastically, I kind of was challenged a little bit. But as soon as I graduated high school, my mother found me. We were all living in this apartment in Midland, Texas, is where I graduated high school. And she came and she found me and she says, Kristen, you have 3 days to pack your things. You're moving to go live with your dad in California. I've met him twice. I'd seen him twice since the divorce. So that was kind of awkward. My mother she constantly badgered him. She was always talking badly about him. So the minute I got off the plane in California, he started talking bad about my mom. And I'm like, what's going on with these people? So anyway, I lived out there. He co-signed for me to get a car, and we lived in a town called Irvine. As soon as I got that car, man, I was down in Santa Monica. I found Long Beach. I found Los Angeles. I found underground bars that stayed open all night. I found heroin. I found cocaine, and always alcohol. So when I guess I was like 18 then, I was working on Hollywood Boulevard in a restaurant overnight called Delta Family Restaurant, and I was an overnight waitress. And the gentleman that I lived with in Venice Beach was my dealer. And with all due respect, Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm an alcoholic junkie crackhead. That's what I am. So he had one thing that he told me, and he says, Kristen, don't ever let anyone come to my apartment when I'm not there. Well, you know, of course, that didn't happen. And the one time it didn't happen, of several, the one time I got caught that it happened, he came into the restaurant where I was working overnight with a knife, and he told that manager, you don't know what kind of cocaine, heroin, I don't want to say the words. I mean, he was saying some pretty vicious words about me. My manager's like, run upstairs in the office. I'll get rid of him. So I did, and my manager and I decided that it would probably be best that I leave. He said, have you got somewhere to go? Probably be a good idea not to go back to that apartment that night. And I said, yes. I said, I think I'll just get in my car and go to Midland, Texas. I think I'll just go back and move in with my mom. So I packed everything that I could fit in my Toyota Celica, had one marijuana cigarette, and I smoked it all the way for 2 days from California, Los Angeles to Midland. I remember my mother asking me before I graduated high school, and she's like, what's your plan? What are you going to do with your life? And I remember looking at her like, I had no idea what a plan looked like, and I had no idea what I wanted to do with my life. So anyway, I moved back in there with her, and it was difficult, and it was awkward. And about that time was when I really started getting into methamphetamines. And, you know, all the while, I thought I was having fun. When I was out using, when I was out drinking, I really thought I was having fun. Until I guess I wasn't. I don't believe in premarital sex, so I eloped with this young boy at the age of 20. We moved... Anyway, we eloped. After high school, I went to California, and he went and joined the Army. And we met back in Midland at a party. I don't know about y'all, but, you know, those beer games. And I just prided myself in that I could outdrink anyone under the table, and I thought that was really cool. My ticket to cool was drugs and alcohol. So we decided that we loved each other, and we decided that we were going to elope, and we moved to Austin, Texas, and that was like in 1987. We were together 10 months. I had started beauty school there in Austin, 38th Street, 38th and a half and 35. Took me about a year to finish beauty school. And when I came home one day, there was a note in our apartment that said, I love you, Kristen. I had to leave you. I was like... I walked into that admissions office at that college, and I said, I'm just going to have to withdraw. I'm just going to have to leave. And she's like, what are you talking about? Get your little smock back on and get back up on the floor, you know. And I'm real grateful for her, and I ran into her a couple of years ago, and I'll tell you all about that maybe in a little bit if I remember. So I went from having a jet black mohawk shaved down to the scalp. It was probably about 5 inches. And I started letting that hair grow out. And I went to work at a bar called New West Nightclub. And so I bought a pickup truck, traded in that BMW convertible with that mohawk, let it grow out, and bought me a pickup truck, learned how to two-step, bought boots and everything. I was having fun. Got my first DWI when I was working there. I think I was 21 and successfully completed that probation. Because, like I said, I'm going back to that original premise, is that I'm like an overachiever and I want to do everything just right. 2 weeks after I successfully completed that probation, I got my second DWI. I guess I was like 24 now. And, you know, back in the day, I don't know if they still have them. They were like, DWI, you can't afford it. And they were on the sides of the road. I'm like, I'll show you I can afford this. You know, it's just pride. Like, and I did. I went to all the outpatient treatments, and I did everything that I was supposed to do. Never, ever surrendered. I'm going to go back to that original premise. When I was done, man, I was done, and I want to stay done, and I want to be happy. So anyway, I've been married 3 times. The first marriage was, I told y'all, and I'll say it again, didn't believe in premarital sex. We're going to fix that. Second marriage, I was pregnant, and the third marriage... It was a marriage of convenience. So on the fourth DWI, I got a fourth DWI in 2009. And I remember that judge when I went to court, and he's looking me eyeball to eyeball. He says, Kristen, we're going to send you to 8 years in Texas Department of Criminal Justice. That was 2009. It's 2016. I'm not in jail. So my turn. Thank you. My attorney said, Chris, go sit down. I'm going to have a few words here. So what they offered me in September of 2009 was a therapeutic community, a 90-day treatment center in Burnett, Texas. Not SafePe. I don't know if anyone knows anything about any of these therapeutic communities. Thank you for our love interaction. Makes me feel like I'm not sitting here talking to myself. My kids be like, Mom, you talking to yourself again? Yes, please don't interrupt. So I'm really glad to hear that there's some interaction up in here. Thank you for that. And I was, too. In September 09, I'm sitting up there in that courtroom with my little dress on, my little espadrilles, my little hair all smooth and nice. And I remember when he told me 8 years in prison, I thought, this guy has absolutely no idea who I am. He has no idea who he's talking to. That day, I left that courtroom, y'all. I went out and drank and drove again. He just told me less than 2 hours ago that I'm not going to prison today, but that I could be in prison for drinking and driving. The book tells, okay, so now that's where I'm at right now. Now, I want to start getting into the book a little bit because I call that Book of Alcoholics Anonymous Christian's Owner's Manual right there. So I successfully completed that 90-day treatment program. It was somewhere in around December. We slept, you know, we wore whites, like I call them scrubs. We were in a jail, a lockdown facility. I was told when to eat, what to eat, metal beds, mattresses. I don't know if anyone can relate to those little bitty mattresses that are all plastic. And it's always cold in there, and they're all loud all the time. They got the dominoes slapping around. You're just like, oh, my God, get me out of here. So somewhere in December, I fell out of my cot. I was on the bottom, and I fell. I always want to throw that in, and I fell. And I was like, it's like I was pushed out, and I fell out of the bed. And I'm like, God, I don't know who you are, what you are. Help me. Went to the Catholic schools growing up. I had a little bit of a conception of God, you know. And it was really, really cold in December. And we would leave. We would go. They had these little portable buildings set up where we do our process group and accountability and this and that, pull-ups, push-ups, down and out. And it was cold, and there were like, I think maybe 90 women making the transfer from the jail cell to these portables. And y'all, I stood there like this, like a hot piece of fudge brownie with just this nice chocolate syrup dripping over it. And it was cold. And I felt warm inside, and I felt peace that I'd never, ever felt in my entire life. I was 43 years old when that happened. I didn't know anything about peace at all, calmness, being still. So when I got out, this is really important. My mother and I didn't speak for 7 years. And by this time, my kids are, I was thinking about it on the way here, is how old they were, 13 and 11, when I got sentenced to go to the therapeutic community. So my mother and I didn't speak for 7 years, and I remember calling my sister the day of that court date when I left, and I said, Molly, I need mother's number. She's like, mother does not want to talk to you. I said, here's what's going on. I'm going to jail. I'm going to treatment. I got to go to jail first for 20 days, and then from there I'm going to wait for a bed and go to treatment. And she says she really doesn't want to talk to you. So that was Monday, and then Wednesday, I called probation. I was like, I don't have anyone. I know no one. My family, they're done with me. I don't have anyone to take care of my children. What do you suggest I do? Kristen, I'm sorry, we can't. Unfortunately, we don't know how to help you with that. I was supposed to check in on Friday. I got a phone call Thursday night late, about 10:30, and it was my mother. And she's like, Kristen, I'm going to come down. I'm going to keep your kids. And you know, being the junkie, alcoholic, drug addict that I am, I was under the influence daily, so I didn't really even know how to accept what I had just heard. And she told me that night, here I am. Okay, so I love this. I got my duffel bag, and I've got my clothing. I got my perfume, my toothbrush. I got all kind of hairspray and makeup. And I walk into Williamson County Jail over here. They're like, what's that? I said, well, I'm going to treatment. So it's my hair dryers, this and that. They said, no, you're not going to be needing that. So I immediately, they let me call my friend who dropped me off, and he came back and he got that duffel bag full of all my pretty stuff. When I was in Williamson County Jail, if you're convicted of a felony in Williamson County, you have to go sit in Williamson County Jail for 20 days, restitution on your felony. And all I saw were like, the women, and they would just sleep. They'd be sleeping all day, and just, I was like, I can't do this. I can't. It was just defog, though. I mean, it was, I didn't want to sleep all day, and I didn't. And I woke up, I don't know, medicine come in about 5 o'clock in the morning. I would sit there, and I'd make that little cot, and I would just sit there on the bed, wait until I could leave and go to take a shower. I wanted to have some sort of normalcy. Because, you see, I wasn't an alcoholic. I never realized I was functioning. I had the house, the executive. I was an executive PTA board member. I was room mom. My son played football. My daughter cheered for his team. I just thought that I had this definitely stereotypical idea of what an alcoholic and a drug addict look like, and I was not that person. I was not your losers. Now, you know, I've been, how grateful I am to know that I'm a loser. No. Lost the obsession. So, when I was in there, I met women that were waiting for their beds in this treatment center, like I'm talking 3 months. 2 months. I'm like, oh, wow. Because they did tell me it'd be a minimum of 20 days, and then I'm going to go to this treatment center. Well, you know what? On that 20th day, they called my name. I wasn't in Georgetown, Williamson County Jail when I had this experience, but off the cot and everything else. And I couldn't believe it. I didn't know. So I went, and they brought me upstairs where I could get my clothes back on. And they put shackles on my ankles. And they put my hands behind my back, and they put handcuffs on me. Book tells me I know a little bit of something about incomprehensible demoralization, 10-4. It was hard. It was hard. I was crying. And so we load up in this 12-seater van, and we start headed out to Burnet, Texas. And I was crying. I was crying the whole way, just like pitiful, just sobbing. Van driver says, Chris, are you scared? I said, I'm real scared. And I was real scared. And because I was fearless before, and I was scared. So we got there, and we got there kind of late. And so I remember them going and getting us some trays of food. And then they got our pretty clothes, or I call them scrubs. And then we went to our jail room. And within a week and stuff, there was like a shakedown or something. I'm not exactly what the terminology was, but scared to death. They gathered all of us women, put us in this cafeteria, and I was scared, man. I was over in a corner, just I was like shaking, like this is, what has my life turned into? What has happened? You know, I always considered myself a lot better than you, or a lot worse than you. That book talks about that pride, that I was either, bless you, I was way, all false now, false pride. I always felt less than you. I wasn't as pretty as you growing up. I wasn't as smart as you until I had that first drink. Then I was like the belle of the ball. I was the best of the best, and I was the smartest and the prettiest and the brightest. Book also tells me I like the effect produced by the alcohol, and I did. So we went through the treatment, and after I fell out of that bed and that peace and that calmness and that serenity that I knew nothing about, man, I didn't know how to, I was at peace. So I took the program by the horns, and I'm not real familiar with the curriculum at Austin Recovery. I just got fired from a treatment center, and their curriculum was, I think, pretty similar. I guess all treatment centers are treatment center with process groups and whatnot. So I took it by the horns, and I took it seriously. When I got out, oh no, I think this is important too, because God does for me what I can't do for myself. The woman, my mother, that came down, took care of my two kids, kept. I rented a little house in Georgetown, and she came down that Friday when I went to check into jail, and she takes care of my niece, who is now like 12 or something. I'm not how old she is, but she would drive. She came down, loaded up my two kids, loaded up my two dogs, and drove to Dallas every weekend back and forth, kept them in school, kept their little cell phones, kept my car, kept the house. I mean, what are you kidding me right now? I didn't speak to her. I did not, unless I needed money. If I needed money or I need anything like that, but during that, obviously, that 7 years, she was done. She didn't want to talk to me about anything. That's a miracle right there, as far as I'm concerned. And then, you know, I don't know if anyone in here has kids, teenagers. And that's a difficult, you know. that's a difficult time when they're going through that adolescence and stuff. So about the time I got sober was about the time my kids started using drugs and alcohol. So the first thing I did when I got out of treatment was go to an AA meeting. I went to the Georgetown White House, and it was birthday night. And I sat there, and at the end of the meeting, you know, they give out chips for 9 months, 6, 3, 2, 1, the desire chips. And I crawled up there, and I guess I crawled up there when she said 3 months. And then I said, can I have a 2, a 1, and a desire also? And I just held her, man. I just hugged her. And I still have those chips today, and I've got a very good relationship with that woman. Another thing I want to back up and talk about was when I was in that treatment center, the felons in Burnett County Jail, the felons weren't allowed to go to the AA meetings that they brought out there. But for some unknown reason, 2 times in 3 months, I was able to go to an AA meeting. The one of them that I got to go to was on my what we call belly button birthday, right on, like my birthday. It was January 12th, and they happened to bring a meeting in that night, and they happened to let me go, whoever wanted to go. And this woman, I remember, and she's like, here, you want this book? I'm like, I don't want your book, man. I've been in AA meetings since I was 18. I got books. I don't want your book. And so, but she just was relentless, and so I took the book. In 2013, I was telling my story in Florence, Texas. And after the meeting, people were gathered around and talking, and I recognized this one. I heard him say, the mixed nuts. Did you go to the meeting, the mixed nuts meeting? Well, that was the women's meeting in Burnett that carried the message to the treatment center, and I heard mixed nuts, and I went, turned my head and listened. And this woman, I looked at her, and she looked at me, and it was like magnet. You just, and we just held each other and just hugged each other, and I still have that book, and I want to put it in a glass box. Man. Ran into her this past weekend. I got to go to an Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, you have your little home groups, and then you have your districts, and then you have your areas. Well, I currently serve as District 22, which is Georgetown, Round Rock, down to some Lago Vista, as the treatment facilities chairperson. And so at this area assembly, there she was again. We just ran up to each other and just hugged each other. I got fired on Monday the 3rd, and the area assembly, I wouldn't have been able to go. It was in Corpus Christi. Y'all, I stayed at the Omni Hotel in a big room all by myself, bayfront, fed, you know. I'm worthy. Yes, I'm worthy. So... what I did when I got into that White House and that Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, I dove right in because they kept telling me, Kristen, if you sit in the middle of this herd right here, we're going to protect you. We're going to protect you. And the first thing they did, too, was grab me down. We have a convention, by the way. It's a convention in Georgetown every March. It's called the Chisholm Trail Convention. And they grabbed me and they told me, you're going to do this and you're going to, you know, service work, cleaning chairs, setting up chairs, cleaning, doing pots and pans and cleaning. And I was like, yes, yes, any form of service work. And I still do service work today. And I have sponsees, about 4 of them right now. They do service work too. I had one girl, she refused to do service work. I said, look, you know, this is life and death for me. And if you're going to come and ask me, this is where I'm going to sound a little bit rude, but if you're going to, no, this is life and death. If, you know, do you want to get sober? Do you want to stay sober? Do you want to be happy? Do you want to be joyous and free? Are you willing to go to any lengths? Are you willing to do what I did? You know, and so a few of them have not been willing to do that. And quite frankly, I can be honest, I haven't seen them, those two. My friends, I have two. No. So my sobriety date, I'll say it again, is November 3rd, 2009. And all I did was suit up, show up, listen to people who told me, Kristen, you never have to drink or use drugs again. And you know what? Alcohol and drugs wasn't an option to me when I crawled in there. I did not want to go to prison. It was, you know, and my initial entry into AA was, I'm not going to prison. Even though I did, after I fell out of that bed and I did experience that serenity, there's still some fear. And I, in my mind, there are some healthy fears in this life, and I'm not going to prison is one of them. But so I sat down. I had like 5 temporary sponsors when I first got out of jail. I just didn't know what to do. I mean, asking for help. And I was in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous one day, and this woman started talking about she lost her kid. And I didn't lose my kids, but I might as well have. I never had any type of emotional bond with either one of them. And even though I was there, I was on that PTA board, and they were in football and cheerleading, and I was room mom. I mean, I was always there. My son, who's 21, about 6 months ago, first time ever, told me, "I love you," and I'll talk about the kids here in just a little bit. So the program of Alcoholics Anonymous saved my life. You know, obviously, if I've had 4 DWIs, I've been court-ordered a time or two to go to these meetings, and I wouldn't get my car forged. I would just go, and I didn't care what you were saying. I remember, y'all were losers, I'm a snob, man, but I'm better today. A little bit. Kidding. So this woman said something in a meeting about losing her kid as a result of her drinking. And I went up to her after the meeting and I said, "Hi, my name is Kristen Walton. I think I might have a problem with alcohol. Will you sponsor me?" And she said, "Absolutely." I said, "Well, I've been working with a few women that I was kind of working with." And I said, one of them, every time she called me, and I got this like knot in my stomach, and I was like, "I'm going to go drink, man. Like, this knot's uncomfortable." I said, "What do I say to her?" She said, "Well, you just tell her that you have found someone else that you're going to work with." She says, "Kristen, one thing you're going to learn is it's not about people pleasing, like me wanting to please her. And if she's, you know, if she's doing the deal, or if she's got a solid program of Alcoholics Anonymous, she ain't going to judge me either." Because, I don't know, that's just what she told me. So I continued to work with that sponsor. We started, I just want to reiterate the importance of service work, because it was so, so important. I remember being up at that White House one day, and if anyone's ever been there, nice, a couple times, beautiful little rickety old house. We've moved. I could tell you about that, too, if you want. So she took her time with me to open that book, and we read it page by page until she helped me to understand what an alcoholic is. She helped me to understand that I'm not a loser, that I'm not a bad person, that I'm suffering from an illness, and it's life or death. And we sat there and we read that forward to the first edition, and it said that I suffer. It didn't say that I suffer from drinking too much, or I suffer from going to jail too much, or leaving my kids while I'm down here on Runberg Lane in the middle of the night, picking up strangers, putting them in my car that I don't even know who they are. Hello. Kids were, 6 and 8, 7 and 9 years old, and I'm running around. I live in Georgetown. So she said it didn't have anything to do with that behavior. She said, "That's just a symptom. That's a symptom of your behavior, of your illness." And it said in there on the forward to the first edition, it says, "Here are 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingless, hopeless state of mind and body." Now, I don't know if anyone can relate to hopeless, but if you had my life, you would drink too, you know? If your brother molested you till you were 26, you'd probably drink too. If you raised 2 kids by yourself, single mom, while their dad's in prison, you'd probably drink too. And then it was I'm justified. You know, I'm entitled to drink. So whatever, it's not about the drinking and the drugs. The drinking and the drugs, the using too much, or that's a symptom. And that's, so she helped me to understand that I suffer from this hopeless state of mind and body. The body, the minute I put any kind of substance in my body, I am guaranteed that the phenomena of craving is going to kick in. And Katie barred the door. You're either on this train or not, because so that's the mental obsession. And, but now the mind, we can work with that. You keep that substance out of your body, we can work with the mind. I remember my son, when I first started going to AA, and he's like, "Mom, that's just a cult." I said, well, yeah, I'm getting some brainwashing. I'm learning. I'm getting clean. He also said, Mother, nothing's changed up in here. You're still gone all the time. And that was early on, about 3 years in. He's like, Mother, when last meeting you went to? You're getting a little crazy up in here. So he comes to respect. Those kids began to see differences. They began to see happiness in our home, and they began to see. I don't know if anyone in here, if you would get off work, man, because you said, I told my kids I am not going to drink today, and I'm in it, and I couldn't fulfill that promise, so I just constantly look like a liar. I'm like, I'm not going to drink today. But then I thought the traffic's a little bit heavy, so I'll go in there, and I'll have two drinks, and by that time the traffic will be clear, and I'll go. Never happened. So the illness of alcoholism has to do, the symptoms are control and choice. If I told you I wasn't going to drink today, that's a choice. I made a choice, and I told you I wasn't going to do it, and I did it like 99% of the time. I couldn't not choose. I couldn't hold that promise I made to them. And then I figure I always brought a $10 bill in my pocket, and I'm going to have two Heinekens, and I'm going to go home. Never happened. There was one time, I don't want to get into too many war stories, but God's got this. I'm just hanging out trying to get to this microphone. Anyway, I'm sure it raises up too, doesn't it, Chris? So control and choice. I suffer from an illness of my hopeless state of body. I suffer from cognitive distortion. There is something wrong with my thinking. There is something wrong with the way that I perceive you and you and you and you and you, and left untreated, when I'm getting a little bit all cognitive distorted, and I'm going to go drink, and I'm going to go use that anger, that shame, that guilt, that anger, that pride, all these things that make up Kristen is going to lead me to a drink. And then when I do drink, I don't want to ever drink again. And when I crawled in those rooms, they said, Chris, you never have to drink again. That was a concept I wanted to embrace, because that wasn't an option. They said, Chris, you don't have to feel that way again. I didn't know what they meant. So I continue to keep going back, and I continue to do service work. I was up there. That was one thought I had. I was sitting up there cleaning the White House. She's singing. He singing. Thank you. And I was up there cleaning, and they're like, one girl came up. She's not in the program either anymore. I haven't seen her in a while. And she says, Chris, you've been gone for about 4 months. Don't you think you ought to be at home with your kids? And I just calmly turned around to her, and I said, thank you, no. I need to be right here. Because early on in sobriety, I could feel when I started getting a little bit aggravated. Book talked about a little bit of restless, irritable, and discontent, and I could feel that coming on, and I was convinced that the drinking's not my problem. I was convinced that it's those feelings. I'm going to seek relief, man. However I find that relief is where I'm going. I'm going to feel better, because I like the effects of that alcohol has on me. So, let's see what else. So, the kids, Henry and Morgan. My daughter is 19. I'll back up a little bit, I guess. I think all treatment programs, and I don't understand the dynamics behind it, if it's state mandated or if it's ordered where we have family group that comes as part of the treatment. So my mother and my daughter would drive out to Burnet, but my son was very, very angry with me, and he didn't come but maybe once. And like I said, about the time I got sober, they started using drugs and alcohol. And Henry did not want to go to Georgetown High School anymore, so he went to this alternative school called Resharte, and he didn't want to go there anymore. And the principal called me, says, Chris, if you don't come get your boy, we're going to call the cops. He's got to get off this campus. And I said, tell that to be a walk. He can walk home and get him off campus. And I don't know if they ended up calling, but I did not. My mother picked me up and coddled me after every scrape. She bought me cars. She bought me vehicles. I'm not the enabler. My daughter at 19, the most beautiful flower I've ever seen in the world, and this girl is beautiful. She's got a crystal meth fetish, and she went and got arrested for possession of a controlled substance in October. Back to the schools real quick, though. So we found this school, they're charter schools, and one is, like, if you're really smart, like, you could work ahead and you can get college credits and stuff for free while you're in this high school. And then the other one is what I call misfit school. That's where my kids went. My kids graduated from that part of it. It's still the, and I, you know, I think misfit's good. I think it's good. Yeah. An alternative, like a, yes. Yeah, yes, yes. So after my son was removed from that campus his senior year, we found Gateway, this high school, and he kind of hung out at home for a while before he decided he was better get that high school diploma. So he finished like 4 months of school credits in like 2 months, knocked it out. I met the principal, love her. So then my daughter had the same kind of things going on, the same kinds of issues, and she didn't like Georgetown High School. I said, well, I love this school, and I love the principal. Maybe you want to give that one a whirl. And she did. November, not last November, but then November before that, she was missing. She didn't come home, and I didn't see. I would go because the principal and I really like her a lot, and I really love her. And she's like, no, Morgan's not here today. I said, is she there today? No, she's not here today. From November to March. And you know what? I stayed sober through that. She was missing, and I didn't drink during that time because there were women up there in that program that helped me. There were guys up there that said, hey, you know, we've been through this. You don't have to drink, Kristen. Remember we told you when you crawled in here, you don't ever have to drink again. So I got a text in March, last March. I said, Mom, can I come home? And I said, yes. So when I pulled up in the driveway, if anyone's familiar with the 12 and 12, they're on page 99, I believe it is. We call it the 11th step prayer. And it talks about, I want to understand. I don't need to be understood. I want to hear you. I don't need to be heard. I want to love you. I don't need to be loved. And I called my sponsor at the time, homosexual friend, man, love him. And he sat there and he said, Kristen, you open up that, book right now and you're going to read that prayer to me. And I did. And he says, you walk in there and you say nothing. And I didn't say a word. He said, you said nothing. And for the first time in my life, really, she was heard, man. And it's because I was sober. It's the only reason, because I was there and I was present and I didn't try to tell her how to do things and my way or no way, just ask my ex-husbands, you know. Don't have to live like that, man. I can live with peace today. So I did. I heard her. I heard every word she said, and I heard about her miscarriage, and I heard about her fights, and I heard about her struggles. And I opened that door in March, in October. So, yeah, in March. So there again, that principal got her through. She graduated, too, by the grace of God and whatnot. So after graduation, the last week of May, she moved out, and I was down with that. And then I got a call in August. Mother, can I come home? I've tried it on my own. I really want to do it on my own. I can't. I said, yes, come on back. I wrote a contract. I typed out a contract, and I said, this is a drug-free home. There's nobody here when I'm not here. And I'll tell you about the home in a minute if you want to hear about it. And she signed it. We had curfews and everything else. That was October, February. She's back in jail again for crystal meth. When she went to court, it was a wash. Okay, it's just like they had not enough evidence on her. And it was in my face when she got out of that courtroom, freed, just like me. Like, I could be in prison right now for drinking. She could be in prison right now for dope. February, she's back arrested again. She spends 5 months in that Williamson County jail. Thanks for asking about the kids. She spends five months in Williamson County jail, and like I said, my mother bailed me out of every single solitary money, and, you know, in the big scheme of pictures, she helped me out, too. I don't know what love is. I don't know how to love, and my mother loves me. She does, and I'm learning a little bit about that right there these days, about love and stuff, commitments, meaning what you say, saying what you mean, but don't say it mean. Progress, not perfection. Anyway, so I found out that she was in jail. I went online kind of looking for her, and I found her. And I went up there and met her court-appointed attorney, and I said, you know, I'm a woman in recovery. I said, my sobriety date, I'll keep saying November 3rd, 2009. I have nothing to do with that. I just said, I'm done. Can somebody please help me? Anyway, I said, if I could handpick something for my daughter up in here, I said it would be, there's that court-ordered treatment center called Central Texas Treatment Center. It is, we call it the cornfield. And I've had the privilege to go out there and carry the message via meeting. I've also had the privilege to go out there and tell a little bit about me and my life and hopefully touch someone, man. If someone can relate, just the truth is, I don't have to feel like that anymore. I don't have to go chase that stuff anymore. I don't have to do that. I don't. So far, I need to find some wood, knock on it. I haven't wanted to. My daughter going to jail, my son, my daughter coming up missing, all of these things, I haven't wanted to drink over it. Anyway, okay, so if I was still, and I did fail algebra, and I'm really proud of this, and it's my largest accomplishment ever. If I was still in prison on that 8-year sentence, I'd be out November 2017. I have to say that 2 years ago, I bought my very first house, and on June 20th, I graduated college with my bachelor's degree. And I'm gonna tell you something, God, I didn't do none of that stuff. Thank you very much for that. Life is good, and I just hope that we can all embrace the idea that we don't have to drink again. I wish I didn't bring my book, and I want to just say something. Can we do a third step prayer? Because when very difficult things happen in my life, when I say this, it gives me a lot of relief. That page 63. So I'm just going to say, and if y'all want to say it, chime in. God, I offer myself to thee to build with me and do with me as thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self so that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties so that victory over them may bear witness to those I may help with thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always. Thank you.